And may I add my welcome to Nigel's. It's lovely to see you here. Thank you very much for coming to join us this evening. I hope you'll thoroughly enjoy your time with us. I'm going to be speaking now for, I guess, 20-25 minutes, something like that. And we've called this series of evening talks that we're running, we run it once a year, and we've called this series Life Actually. And I've called it that because I want us to see over the course of this week that Jesus Christ is the one man who can give us life as it is actually intended to be lived in God's world. That is, life connected to God now, in this creation, living with God our Creator as He meant us to live, and, in a sense, more significantly, certain life beyond this life in God's physical new heaven and new earth. Life actually. Straight away, what I want to ask you to do is to pick up this blue copy of John's Gospel. As Nigel said, John is an eyewitness of the life and teaching of Jesus Christ. I want to ask you to turn to page 60, right at the back end there, because John very helpfully, right at the back of his Gospel, tells us why he's written. It's always rather useful when somebody does that in a book. And you can see the purpose of this book at the top of the page there. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these signs, that is, are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, that's God's King, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name. So we're on track. You can see what we're doing this week. We can see why we're looking at John's Gospel, because John's purpose is that we may see who Jesus is and realize that in Jesus we can have life now with God, our Creator, as we were meant to live, and life in eternity in God's new heaven and new earth, connected to God. Now, obviously, we haven't got time to look at the whole of the Gospel. I wish we had. And therefore, again, straight up front, I want to mention to you this Christianity Explored leaflet that we'll talk about later on, which is another seven evenings rather like this, which you might like to look at and think about as the evening goes on, talk about it over pudding. Another opportunity to look into the teaching of Jesus. If anything you hear this evening makes you say, yes, I really ought to think about this, perhaps for the first time for many years. But what I'm going to do now is we're going to get straight down to business and turn back to page 6, and we're going to look at the very first sign that John records for us, Jesus turning water into wine. And I'm going to ask Jen Lord, who is sitting somewhere, to come up here and read it for us, and I think it's on page 6. It's at John chapter 2, verse 1.
John chapter 2, verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and the disciples believed in him.
Jen, thank you very much. Well, I don't think my job is actually that difficult this evening. You know, people who say you have to spend hours interpreting the Bible, actually the writer has told us what we are to make of this story right there in verse 11, and therefore I will have succeeded in my job in trying to make sense of this sign, if at the end of the day we can say verse 11, this, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and he showed his glory, and the disciples believed in him. Well, I've just got 2 points. The first, if you worry about these sort of things, is significantly longer than the second, just so that you can be relieved and happy about that. And the first point is this, that this sign shows Jesus' glory. He is Lord, both of this creation and the next creation. We can trust him. And as I say, the point is there in verse 11. John wants us to realize the glory, the majesty, the wonder, the splendor of Jesus Christ. And there are several aspects, just on a straight reading of this incident, that show the glory of Jesus Christ. Just the straightforward quantity of the wine. Look at verse 6 for a moment. There were 6 stone water jars there for the rite of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Now, I got my calculator out. 6 times 25 is 150. Divide 150 by the usual size of a bottle of wine, and you end up with 870 bottles, or 72 cases. I don't know if you're married what your wedding was like, but this is quite some wedding, even though they lasted for a week in those days. Try it next time you're coming through customs with 72 cases of wine in your boot. It's for a wedding officer. The sheer quantity of the wine speaks of the splendor and the majesty of Jesus Christ. And then there's the glorious quality of the wine. Look at verse 10. The master of the banquet, who was obviously very experienced in this sort of thing, said, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people are drunk freely, then the poor wine, but you've kept the good wine, the best, till now." So this is the best. This is Chateau Margaux or Petrus. I'm sitting on a table with a lot of bankers from Schroeder's, and this is the sort of thing they drink at their client lunches. I mean, it's not the sort of, you know, plastic cork thumping hangover, one glass, serious headache, don't forget the Alka-Seltzer stuff that you and I are used to. This is the very best. And the sheer quality of the wine shows the glory of Jesus Christ. And then there's the supernatural power, which you can't have missed, can you? There's no kind of David Blaine illusory magic to the work of Jesus. There's no self-publicity, no media deal, no Perspex cage, camera crews and fat check. He doesn't boast about it. He quietly issues his orders to the servants, and the water is turned into vintage. The quality, the quantity, the supernatural power. And as I've thought about this over the weeks, this and this alone, I think, would be enough to cause us to begin to trust in Jesus Christ, the Lord of this creation and the next. This is not the kind of thing that human beings do. If you think it is, let me encourage you, when you go home, get to your kitchen table, fill up the water jug, stick it down in the middle, sit down opposite, and give it a go. Quietly, when no one's watching. Now, the sheer supernatural splendor of this demonstrates the glory of Jesus Christ. But if we were to leave it there, I think we wouldn't really have done justice to this incident. Nor, I think, would we really have understood the point of it. See, whenever I've studied this sign, it's the first sign that John records for us to show us the glory of Jesus Christ and show us that he can give us life with God. Whenever I've looked at this sign, I've always asked myself, well, why this one? After all, even if you know anything about the life and works of Jesus, Jesus did many more, much more splendid, public signs and miracles. He healed a boy on the point of death at a distance of around about 20 miles. He fed 5,000 people in Galilee so that they pursued him relentlessly, leaving everything for the next few days. He healed a man who had been crippled for 38 years and whose muscles and joints had begun to wither and contract. He walked on water. He gave sight to a man born blind, such that no one could deny it. He raised a man who had been dead for 4 days and whose flesh had begun to rot. He himself was raised from the dead. So why is it that John records this sign first for us to show us the splendour and glory of Jesus? And how is it that this sign shows us his splendour and glory? And that's why I asked Nigel to ask you to pick up that cream-coloured card. Because if you ignore the running order, because we're knocking along there quite smoothly to target so far, and turn to the back of the running order, what I've done is I've asked, we've had printed out there, a quote from the first part of the Bible, what's known as the Old Testament. And I've had that quote printed out because one of the big ideas in the first part of the Bible is of God's people as his bride and God's son or God's king as his bridegroom. And heaven described as a glorious wedding banquet with the finest food and the best drink available. It, technically, if you're interested in this sort of thing, you know, the Boffins, they call it the Messianic Banquet. But we needn't bother with that. We'll just call it heaven. And it comes through God's king who brings God's people into this physical new creation, the new heaven and new earth. Let me read it to us. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. And he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over every nation. He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. It will be said on that day, behold, this is our God. We've waited for him, that he might save us. This is the Lord. We've waited for him. Let us be glad and rejoice in his salvation. Well, now, there is this Old Testament, first part of the Bible, promise from God of a future, physical, new creation, which God brings in through his glorious Messiah, King. Notice, won't you, there's no mention of harps or clouds or ephemeral figures floating bodilessly dressed in nighties. It is physical. It's really earthy. It is a new creation with everything that spoils this creation removed and all that is wholesome and good and glorious and wonderful about this creation there in it. And let me say, if you're here as a vegetarian, the rich food full of marrow is, I think, probably not compulsory. Now, we could have gone to the prophet Hosea, we could have gone to the prophet Jeremiah, we could have gone elsewhere in Isaiah, we could have gone back to the beginning of the Bible in Genesis. All the way through the first part of the Bible, God is promising this glorious future. Again and again and again, his king will come. He will come as a bridegroom, and he will draw his people together, for he is Lord of this creation and Lord of the next. Now, do you begin to see, with that kind of background, why this first sign is so immensely significant? You see, as we look at this sign, we can see back now in John 2, so you can turn back to page 6, we can see there that Jesus does everything that the bridegroom is meant to do. He creates the fine wine of the banquet, which in those days the groom's family was meant to provide. Thoroughly bad idea as far as I'm concerned, but there we are. And in verses 9 and 10, when the master of ceremonies tastes the wine, he goes to the bridegroom, "You've kept the good wine now," the sheer quantity, the sheer quality, the sheer supernatural splendor. And it's as if John is saying, look, in this obscure village, in this out-of-the-way backwoods province of this occupied vassal state, here is a sign. This is to show that God's bridegroom, the Creator, has stepped down onto this planet. He is Lord of this creation. I mean, he does many other things to show that he is Lord of creation, but here is the first one to show that he is Lord of creation. Here is the bridegroom come to call together his people fit for a new creation in heaven forever. It's a sign. It's only a sign. The real McCoy isn't here. I mean, you can taste the wine on your table. You know the real McCoy isn't here. You haven't got the Chateau Petrus yet. It's jolly nice wine, isn't it? But it's not the Margaux or whatever. It's not here yet. Yes, we still suffer. We still die. But Jesus has given us the sign to show us that he is the King, the bridegroom. This is life, actually. Here is the one who can introduce us to life now with our Creator as we come to know Jesus. Here is the one who can give us certainty of life beyond in the new heaven and new earth. If you ever watched Tom Hanks's film Forrest Gump, I'm told that it is still a must-see movie. And it's one of those great Hollywood films that has the kind of, you know, the Hollywood philosophical moment 10 minutes before the end. I like the kind of films like that because basically the plot rumbles along regardless. You can pop out, make yourself a cup of tea, have a drink, you know, cook your supper, nip out round to the corner shop for a few minutes. You come back, and as long as you're there for the 10 minutes before the end bit, you've got the point. And actually the plot is fairly regardless. You know what's going to happen at the end anyway from the beginning. Gladiator is like that, isn't it? And Braveheart and Dances with Wolves, if you remember that epic. Well, right at the end of Forrest Gump, Hanks stands on the edge of a cliff, I think, as I remember it. And as he stands there, he watches a feather that appears to have come from nowhere, floating down out of the sky, down the cliff face to nowhere. And then here is the Hollywood moment. I won't try the accent. I don't know who was right, Lieutenant Dan or Mom, whether each of us has a destiny or whether we're floating like feathers on a breeze. Do you remember it? It was one of the big questions of the last 50 years, hasn't it been, I suppose? For 50 years now, we've been told, haven't we, by the capitalists, the communists, the consumerists, the scientists, that we've come from nowhere, we're going to nowhere, we're just each of us floating like feathers on a breeze. John, in this first sign, says, no, we've come from somewhere. There is a Creator. We are going to somewhere. There is a heaven. There is a hell. There is a life beyond this life. There is a purpose to this life now. Jesus Christ is Lord of this creation and Lord of the next. And if we come to him, we can begin to live life in this creation as we were made to live it. Life, actually. So there's our first point, as I say, the bulk of our material. But secondly, if the sign shows us Jesus' glory as the bridegroom, he is Lord of this creation and Lord of the next, what I'm going to call the hour shows us Jesus' glory and confirms Jesus' glory as bridegroom. And what I want to do now is, some of you may have noticed this, turn to what I think is the big conundrum of this passage and really would set the analysts from the banks around here puzzling. It's there in verse 4, we'll come to it in a moment. For if Jesus really is God's bridegroom, come in all his glory to call out his people for his new creation, if that's who Jesus is, then it raises all sorts of questions. Do ask them. I guess the biggest one is this, you know, if Jesus really is God's bridegroom, how can he ever accept somebody like you or me? Picture of a bridegroom and a wedding feast is a wonderful one. I love the Bible because it's full of kind of tangible pictures that we can really get to grips with. And the picture of a wedding feast speaks of intimacy, of joy, of deep relationship, as a fresh start. You know, I love weddings. I remember my own wedding as I've got to say I love my own wedding. I did love my own wedding. I remember as I turned and watched the girl of my dreams, who isn't here sadly tonight, shimmering down the aisle towards me. It's a wonderful moment, isn't it? In fact, I find weddings highly emotional. I take a lot of them here, as you can imagine. And I frequently have to get a grip on myself and remind myself I'm not the mother of the bride. But it doesn't do, does it, have the vicar in floods of tears at the front. But when it comes to God and to his glorious heaven and to God's sinless purity and his perfection and his absolute purity, you know, I have to look at myself and say, you know, surely I am unfit even to be a guest at this wedding feast, even to be sort of someone working the sound system on the side or a caterer, let alone part of his bridal party. You see, you may well look at yourself this evening and say, well, I'm a reasonably decent sort of individual, you know, sort of score about 83% or something like that. But surely if any one of us couldn't possibly consider ourselves fit for the kind of depth of relationship and joy and intimacy that is being spoken of here in terms of belonging to Jesus Christ, God's bridegroom, as his bride in that sort of relationship. How could God ever welcome me? I mean, I haven't been faithful to God, have you? I have failed to love God and God alone, haven't you? To extend the picture, I've given myself to other partners, so as to speak. I've embraced other lovers than God. I have dished out my favours, my energies, my devotion. A young man from a foreign country, whom none of you will know, had a near-perfect marriage with, the woman of his dreams. Their friends described them as the perfect couple. He loved her deeply. She trusted him absolutely. And one night, here in the city, he did something that I know he will regret deeply for the rest of his life. He turned in here the next day, a foreign visitor paying a one-off trip to the city with a team of colleagues. And when we discussed it and talked about it together, he was at a loss to find words to describe the stupidity of what he had done. It involved an office outing, a great deal of alcohol, and another woman. And we sat just down there by the pillar and talked it through. And as we spoke, he was virtually unable to get the words out through tears of shame, and he longed for reconciliation. But the marriage bed had been defiled. And his question was, how could I ever be accepted back into that sort of depth of relationship following what I have done? And the picture of marriage and of a bridegroom and his bride, I think, is a brilliant one, isn't it? For this relationship now in this creation and on into the new creation that God is offering us. And as we think about ourselves in relation to Jesus, I find it hard to believe that there can be any one person here this evening who is not conscious of our own inadequacy, our own fickle faithlessness to God. Not just a one-night stand, sort of by mistake, but over and over and over and over and over and over again, choosing alternative lovers, other foci for my devotion. Think of your thought life. Think of your motives. Think of your loves. Think of your actions. Think of the way you've treated your body. Think of the way you've treated other people's bodies. And that takes us to the great conundrum of verse 5, and what I'm going to call the hour, which I think confirms for us that Jesus is God's wonderful bridegroom. Just look at verse 4. Did you ask yourself, and I hope you did, it showed you were actually switched on when we were reading through verses 1 to 11. Verse 4. Jesus said to his mother, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? my hour has not yet come. Well, that should set you asking, what on earth does he mean by that? And to cut a long story short, if you turn over to chapter 12, which is on page 38, we find the answer as to what the hour of Jesus is in John's Gospel. There it is on page 38, John chapter 12, verse 22. Philip went and told Andrew, Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus, and Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." Turn over a couple more pages to chapter 17, verse 1. Chapter 17, verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you." The hour in John's Gospel refers to the hour of Jesus' death and resurrection. And at the cross, at Jesus' death, the true hour of his glory comes. For on the cross, Jesus, God's bridegroom, the Lord of this creation and the next, died. As he died, he carried all of God's judgment at our moral failure and fickle unfaithfulness. And on the cross, he cleansed away all the filth and impurity of your life and mine. And once again, that makes the picture of the bridegroom with which John starts his gospel such a brilliant one, doesn't it? For it is as if John presents us right at the beginning of his gospel with Jesus, if you like, a bridegroom, standing at the altar, so as to speak, waiting for his bride. And as he turns to see and to look to the end of the aisle, he sees you or me. But instead of the glorious white wedding clothes of an unspoiled, faithful bride, he sees us in the flimsy, skimpy garment of a street woman, tattered and stained, with the marks of our past life lived out, rejecting God. Our bodies battered and bruised by previous lovers, scars of other delights. And it's as if he holds out his hands to welcome us at the beginning of John's Gospel. And as we look at his hands, we see in the risen Jesus Christ the marks of the cross. For he died to cleanse away the past. And it's as if he says, "I am Lord of this creation, Lord of the next creation. I have died for you. Will you? Will you follow?" Well, I finished. Basically, I was going to say, this starts the gospel off with an invitation. It is a sort of invitation, isn't it? An invitation to a wedding banquet. But I think that's probably wrong. I think John starts off the gospel with a proposal. A proposal. Here is the bridegroom. He is Lord of this creation. He is Lord of the next. He can connect you to God now, tonight. He can open up eternity to you forever. He has died for you. And the proposal goes like this: will you have this man to be your Lord? Great. Well, I'm going to stop there. And Nigel, I'm going to hand over to Nigel. And then questions, it will be a big help to me. Anyway, if you have questions, if you fill them out more or less straight away, so that I can have a look at them before we get down to answering them.
Well, if I could interrupt you for the last time and draw us back together. Thank you very much for all your questions. There are many of them. And they're very good questions, so thank you for that. I'm afraid we're not going to have a chance to tackle all of them, but we've tried to choose a sort of representative sample, and I'm going to put them to William. And we've got about 20 minutes. We're going to try and finish about 9:30. If you haven't got to go then, we can stay around, but our formal part will finish. So let's get cracking with these. William, first of all, some questions, I think mainly on the particular passage you were speaking from before some more general ones. First of all, what is the significance of filling the purification jars?
Yes, thank you very much. There may be significance in that. The purification water was used for cleansing, and it may be a statement that under the old system before Jesus, the Lord of creation, the one who died on the cross to cleanse, comes, there was need of cleansing by water in the old religious system. That may be true, and it may be an indication that Jesus has come to provide real cleansing, a glorious white wedding garment, if you like, as opposed to what constantly needed repurification. The trouble with doing John's Gospel is there are so many different levels of things that you could explore, and I'm just trying to stick to the main track of how does this show his glory. That's why I didn't mention that. That is a good point.
Thank you. Again, a detail of the passage. What is the transition from chapter 2, verse 4 to verse 5? Because it seems Jesus tells his mother off. This has got nothing to do with me. Don't pin it on me, he says. Said often by a son to his mother. And then he actually does what she asked him to do.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm really glad that that is there when Jesus says, this has got nothing to do with me, my hour has not yet come. If it weren't there, we might think that Jesus has arrived with all the fulfillment of the first part of the Bible, the Old Testament. Do you remember that passage we read? The shroud of death removed, the glorious wedding banquet. And I think that is there to show us that this is just a sign. It's a signpost, if you like, pointing to Jesus as the one who will bring in the real McCoy in heaven. But this is not the real McCoy. So he says, look, my time hasn't come. This isn't it. What's this to do with me? It's too early. Just to prevent us thinking, because if I was standing here saying, oh, by the way, Jesus is the bridegroom, he's removed the shroud of death, there'll be no more crying or tears, I mean, all of us know that that is actually not true. There will be a day in heaven where there'll be no more crying or tears. And I think that verse 4 is deliberate and 5 is deliberately there to show us that Jesus, yes, is the one, but he hasn't brought it yet. And it's, at the moment, is the time of engagement, as he calls us. Engagement is probably better than, it's a proposal, isn't it? He calls those who are going to be in heaven with him, those of us who respond to his invitation. Okay?
Thank you. There was another question on that piece of paper about bridegroom, and there's one here too, so don't worry. Why does John use the idea of a bridegroom? And there was a question of how are men meant to relate to the idea of being a bride? Which doesn't come quite so naturally.
Not to me, anyway. Right, okay. How is the male Christian? That's right. Well, it's a metaphor. I mean, it's picture language, isn't it? And it's a huge Bible picture language for the intensity and depth of relationship that God wants with you and me. And that's why it's such a brilliant picture, isn't it? You go to Isaiah 54, you'll find it there. You go to Genesis 2, you'll find it there. It runs right the way through the Bible, this picture language. Christianity is not like religion, running through humdrum rules and regulations and rituals and, you know, 1 hour a week in church, going into the building and getting it all sorted out and then, you know, cracking on. It's not a religion in that sense. It's a relationship. It's not about weird ceremonies. It's about a relationship. And it's a picture language, a metaphor, the bride. And I think any man, you know, however right-brained you are or left-brained or whatever it is, you can understand what's behind the picture, I hope. How are men meant to relate to that? Well, we're meant to say God actually wants a real relationship. Him as Lord, me as knowing him and being known by him, forgiven, and experiencing life in his world with him as my creator. So that's the picture. I don't think it's a hard one to understand. Also, as example, if Jesus is the perfect bridegroom, then it shows us how we should treat our wives. But that's a different story.
This sort of follows on from that. Just takes a slightly step further. You made many references to sex in the talk, especially sex outside marriage. Is this a major issue for Christ?
It's no more major than any other way of living in rejection of the way he wants us to live and in rejection of him. There's no more major than anything else. So I don't mean to make anything major out of it any further than any other aspect of life, where I am living my life with no reference to the rule of Jesus Christ. But of course, in a talk where the main metaphor is bride and groom, and where the talk of the cross is about forgiveness, then I've used illustrations from the sphere of relationship. That's why I had so many illustrations, only because that's the sphere of reference of this part of the Bible. I didn't want to make more of, you know, sex outside of marriage than I would of lying or any other illustration that I am an out-and-out rebel against God in his world.
Thank you. Okay, we move now to a variety of questions which are more general, bigger scale, from the passage, starting off with, the existence of God. Everything you said was all well and good. Thank you. But all of it presupposes the existence of God. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm glad you say it's all well and good, because if Jesus is Lord of this creation, then he has absolute authority to rule over your life and mine, which is quite a big thing to acknowledge. It's the first step, really, of getting started as a Christian. But on the wider issue, it presupposes the existence of God. Yes, how do I respond? Look at Jesus. Here is a historical account of the life of Jesus Christ. Read it. The figure introduced here, to coin an age-old argument, is either completely off his rocker, totally mad, or he's really wicked. I mean, to go around saying the sort of thing we're going to look at in a moment, he who does not honour me does not honour the Father God. To say that, if you don't honour me, you're not honouring God. I mean, that's a wicked thing to say if you are not divine. Or to say, I and the Father are one, is a wicked thing to say, especially if you persuade millions, millions and millions of people to follow you down through the centuries. So look at the character introduced. Look at what he does. Look at his claims. Look at how he lives. Look at his character. Listen to his teaching. And you have to come to the conclusion, either I'm going to write this off and oppose it, or I'm going to say he's just nuts, or I'm going to say, yep, all you said, William, is well and good. I will surrender and bow the knee to Jesus Christ.
Thank you. Another big area of Christianity and science, it's not quite a question so much as three statements, but I think we can get the point. Evolution versus the Bible, geology versus the Bible, fact versus fiction, ? So Christianity and science.
Yeah, thanks. I'm not a geologist, I'm a geographer. Which isn't saying a great deal, is it, I'm afraid? I'm sorry about that.
You're very good at colouring in
that. Yeah. Four sides per essay, one fact per side, and don't forget your colouring in pens. That's how you get your exams if you're a geographer. Anyway, that's completely beside the point. Evolution versus the Bible. Personally, not every Christian would agree with me on this, and there are, you know, clear believing Christians who would take a slightly different line, but personally, I do not think that the Bible rules out some form of development of species. That's my personal belief. Reading Genesis 1 and 2, I think you have to look and say, what is this piece of literature trying to tell us? And I think if I had half an hour, I'd be able to make a very strong case that the author is primarily trying to show us that God made everything. Exact time scales and all the rest of it, I don't think of particular concern to the author in Genesis 1 and 2. His main point is God made everything. What that does rule out is what theologians might call evolutionism. That is, evolution with no design and no designer. So mechanistic evolution, that we're just governed by, you know, the random choices of DNA that is put forward by people like Jacques Monod and Richard Dawkins later. Those kind of arguments, I think you have to say, a Christian could not line up with. But I want to turn around, I would want, if I had longer, to turn the table on the scientist and say, look, when you're doing your scientific investigation, most scientists I find who are doing a scientific investigation into God rule out the possibility of God existing and doing supernatural things before they start their experimentation. Now, that to me is phony science. It's cheating. It's not scientific at all. If you say, oh, I don't believe supernatural things can happen, therefore Jesus could not have done supernatural things, ergo there is no God, then you're just conning yourself. I mean, that is bad science. And I would say, look at Jesus. If God exists, you have to allow, in fact, you would be the first to say to me, if I said to you, actually, God exists, Jesus is God, but by the way, he didn't do anything supernatural, you, scientists, would be the first to complain. You'd come to me and say, hold on a second, you expect me to believe that Jesus is God and he didn't do anything supernatural? That's outrageous. So when you then look at Jesus and you see Jesus did do supernatural things, and I say, well, don't rule out the possibility that God exists, because if you rule out the possibility that God exists, then you're a rotten scientist because you've ruled out one of the solutions before you've begun your experiment. Well, now, Jesus then does supernatural things. Does that not make you ask whether possibly he might be God? So anyway, that's the sort of line, if I had a bit more time, I'd want to push you on.
William, thank you. This is another very big area, and the clock is ticking, but this is the area of Jesus and other religions, and there's two questions. How is Jesus unique and to be recognised as such apart from the miracles? What else sets him apart from the other world religions? And then following on, aren't all religions basically the same, i.e. lead a good, decent life?
Thank you. I think these are really big questions, and I'd love to have a lot longer. I want to just push and advertise Christianity Explored to you again. I mean, these are the sort of things which you can, everything we've been talking about, you can look at over 7 weeks, one evening a week. We won't charge you. It's similar to this evening. I don't think there are any candles and that sort of thing, but I mean, it's a very similar sort of feel to this evening. And it's a great opportunity to come and look at the claims of Jesus Christ. Sorry, what was the question again? How is Jesus unique?
The answer is Christianity Explored, but yeah. the question is other religions.
Yeah. I've just done Christianity Explored, actually, with a friend of mine who was inquiring, and I mean, we thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was really worth doing. So there you go.
Back to the question.
How is Jesus unique? I think this is an extremely difficult question to answer, and one, you know, you can only just skate over the surface in a few seconds, and forgive me that I will now make one or two major generalizations. Look at the claims of Jesus. Just pick up your blue gospel again and turn to page 415. John 5:23, bottom of page 14, halfway through verse 23. Have you got it? Look at verse 22. The Father judges no one. He has given all judgment to the Son, so that all may honour the Son, just as they honour the Father. That is a staggering claim. Do you know what Jesus is saying there? That you will meet Jesus Christ at the end of your life. He is your judge. Now look at the big thing here. No other religion founder would say that of himself. Look at the next thing. Whoever does not honour the Son does not honour the Father who sent him. I mean, if Muhammad was standing with Jesus there, he'd pick up stones to stone him. Just turn over a couple of pages to chapter 8, verse 58. It's on page 27. God's name, by the way, in the first half of the Bible is I Am. That's what God calls himself. I Am. The present tense. Continuous. He always is and always will be. Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I Am. So, they picked up stones to stone him. Turn over to chapter 10, verse 30. Page 32. Chapter 10, verse 30, about 1.5 inches down from the top there on the left. I and the Father are one. The Jews picked up stones again to stone him. Now, there's just one area. There's just three little verses we've gone to. One area in which Jesus Christ is totally unique and utterly different from all other religions. You can see he's totally different from the Jewish religion, because the Jews picked up stones to stone him for blasphemy, because he's claiming to be God. Because to the Jews, there is only one God. He's just in one being. The idea that there might be three gods in one being is blasphemous. So Christianity is totally unique in that regard. Aren't all religions basically the same, i.e. live a good and decent life? No. Christianity is totally different in this regard. Yes, the major world religions will tell you to be good. Actually, interestingly, including atheism now amongst the liberal humanists, they want you to be good too. But let's stick with the major world religions who want you to be good. Hinduism, improve your karma, go round the circle of life, get better and better and better, and eventually you will reach God. Buddhism, walk the eightfold path. Actually, they don't believe in God at all. They're a kind of atheistic religion. But be good along the eightfold path and spiral inwards until you escape from reality. Islam, the five pillars of Islam. Climb the ladder and eventually you will reach God if you've done enough pilgrimage, prayer, almsgiving, saying the creed and whatever the fifth one is.
Fasting. I can't remember.
Thank you. Fasting very much. Fasting, thank you very much. Okay, Judaism, the same. Keep the Torah and eventually you will reach God. Nominal Christianity, that is false Christianity. Be good. Be a decent person. Climb the ladder and you will get to God. That is false Christianity. It's not what genuine Christianity teaches. The big difference with genuine Christianity is you're never going to be good enough. Your bridal garment is ruined. Come on, let's face it. We have not lived in relationship with God. I haven't. I'm not standing here saying I've lived in relationship with God. I haven't. My dress is tattered, if you like, so, you know, that sort of language. Genuine Christianity says God has reached down. He has died on a cross. He has paid for everything that you and I have done wrong, so that I can be connected to God, because I could never, ever, ever connect myself to God, however hard I tried, because I'll never be good enough. Now, I once sat and explained that to a Buddhist, just down in the front row there at a carol service we had here. And he looked at the diagram I'd drawn of all these spirals and ladders and then this reaching down, and he said, "William, what you're saying is what we're striving for, you've got." And that's absolutely right. Because Jesus has forgiven me. If you come to Jesus the bridegroom, he'll give you a fresh start, a whole new beginning, forgiveness, cleansed, a place in heaven for certain tonight, which you can be sure of. And no world religion offers you that. Okay, so those, I think, are the two big differences, the claims of Christ and then the death of Jesus.
William, thank you very much. Now, our time is nearly gone.
And Skate, I reckon we can manage a few more.
We can manage a couple more, but let me just say there are a couple of questions on trusting the Bible, a number, in fact, and I wonder if the easiest thing to do is to recommend a book.
Or the tape. We tackled that on Sunday night. One, two.
There is a book available, which I'm sure whoever has brought you tonight would gladly buy for you. I'm sure they would.
It's £45.
Yes. Yeah. And they'll buy it smiling. No, it's a book called The Case for Christ, and it does give a chap called Lee Strobel. He's a legal journalist who investigated Christ for himself, and he interviews a variety of experts on a number of topics, one of which, or quite a few of which, are all to do with the reliability of the New Testament. And if that's an issue for you, I'd recommend that book. It's very helpful. Mm. And I'm going to move straight on to the next question.
Great.
I'm quite happy with the way things are going now. Why do I need Jesus as my bridegroom?
Yeah, thank you very much. Because we're talking about eternity here. And Jesus steps into this world and says, actually, we are not just made for this world. We're made for a relationship with God now and for eternity. Jesus says, I am God's judge. You will have to give account to Jesus at the end of your life. He's shown that he is God's Lord and judge. And Jesus says, if you do not honour me, you do not honour the Father who sent me. Now that makes sense, doesn't it? Stop and think about it just for one second. If you would only give me tonight that Jesus is a good man sent from God, okay, if that's all you will allow, that Jesus is a good man sent from God to teach us truth. Jesus says, if you do not honour me, you do not honour the Father who sent me. We've seen it. So even if you only say that Jesus is just a good man sent from God, Jesus is saying to you tonight, if you fail to honour Jesus, you're showing you hate God. You don't want anything to do with God. Because Jesus has come from God. And he says, if you don't honour me, you don't honour God. Now, I want to say that all of us have failed to honour Jesus. Me, as much as anybody, more than anybody. And therefore I need forgiveness, because I will meet him one day. I'm not just a feather floating through the breeze. God has not made you just for 30, 40, 50, 70 years. He's made you for eternity. And to spend eternity separated from Jesus Christ would be, I think, there's only one word for it, isn't there? And the Bible calls it hell. So that's why it matters.
William, thank you. Two quick questions to finish are both more on sort of how we respond. Quoting John chapter 12, whoever loves his life will lose it, whoever hates his life in this world will keep it. This would seem to suggest we cannot enjoy life, although that's not what God intends. What is meant about hating your life, that is responding to Jesus?
Yes, it's not meaning I must hate myself. It's not meaning that I must be an Eeyore. There are other Eeyore. Do you know Eeyore? You know, the bloke with the tail that keeps falling off. The donkey with the tail that keeps falling off. I could take you to 1 Timothy 4 and show you that actually to say that this creation is bad is something God hates. He doesn't want us to be ascetics in the desert, you know, eating locusts and all that sort of caper. He wants us to enjoy this life and this world. The Bible says that very clearly. But if I say in this life, living for me today, and rejecting Jesus Christ is what I want to do, then I will lose my life for eternity. So whoever loves his life, that is, whoever loves living just for me, without recognition of God, whoever loves ruling the roost, Frank Sinatra, I'll do it my way in God's world, well, then you'll lose your life. That's what Jesus is saying. It's not my words, it's his. Don't pick a fight with me or St. Helens, please, or the friend who brought you. Pick a fight with Jesus. It is Jesus who's saying this. And he says to you, if you love your life, then you will lose it. If loving your life means I want to be king of my own life and I won't recognize God's king.
Well, just on the flip side of that, what is it to hate your life and therefore receive eternal life? And this question is very much that question, only in different language. What do I need to do if I want Jesus my Lord?
Great, thank you. I think I want to say, however much I know of Jesus, whatever he has shown me of himself to date, I need to say, yes, I want to follow you. I trust you. And then act on it. See, there'll be people right the way across the spectrum here this evening. Some people, maybe the first time you've been in to hear anything Christian forever in your life. Maybe you've never heard of Jesus ever before. Well, however much I have heard of Jesus, however much he's shown me of himself, what do I need if I want Jesus on my Lord? I need to say, yes, I trust you. I will act on it. I will follow you at that point. I think that's probably as far as I would want to go. I would then say, well, you know, you don't start a relationship, because we've been talking relationship all night. I mean, what would you say if my wonderful wife, Janet, if she said, yeah, I'll marry you. We got married, and then she said, all right, farewell, see you in 20 years' time. I mean, just sort of, I mean, you might have made her life a lot happier, but I mean, that isn't how you pursue a relationship, is it? So if you say, yes, I want Jesus as my Lord, yes, I want you as my Lord. Now, how can I want to find out about you. I want to know what you want, how you want me to live in your world. What does it mean to be forgiven? And again, you know, there are any number of ways in which we could help you, or you take away John's gospel. This Christianity Explored thing is a really great thing to do. But ask the friend who brought you. I think that's the best thing. Ask the friend who brought you. They'll tell you all about it.